technology is leapfrogging in not just one area, it's in multiple areas. And then what is so exciting about that is because they're all converging. And because they're converging, it just gives quantum jump to the way we are all going to live our future. Today, you can make a payment. A decade ago, you know, no one would dream that you can actually go down Bangalore roads and drink a tender coconut and pay UPI transaction, right? If someone would brush it off as a joke.
Right.
But today it's possible because common man has been able to really benefit from this technology, right? And that's because of the security that has been thought through. We started off as a services organization, right? And that's the only way you can bootstrap an organization to success. I mean, because products obviously have a lot of investments that is required. You need investments, and obviously the ecosystem was not really there.
Right.
And second, of course, we always believed that, like Vinod Khosla says, right, at the end of the day, you know, 70% of the VCs don't help, and 90% of the VCs actually do more harm than good.
For all those young entrepreneurs who are yet to, you know, kickstart their venture, but they're seriously considering cyber, right? And they might be having that bent of mind and acumen and the technical know-how, but may not know which path to follow. I know it's going to be a different journey for everyone. It cannot be the same. You can't apple to oranges. But what are your three or four recommendations which you think might work for most of them?
Yeah, so first of all, it's hard.
So welcome everyone to yet another edition of Security Chips, the DSA Security Podcast. Today we have with us Mr. Darshan Shantamurthy, CEO and founder of CISA. Welcome, Darshan. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Aditya.
All right. So Darshan, you know, let me start by talking about the growth story, the cyber growth story of India. Right. So lately, we have all witnessed that it has hit some real strides, right, globally. So what do you think are the factors that are driving India's growth story across the globe?
One of the key things, I think, is the ecosystem, right? For any company and organization to grow, I think the ecosystem should be there. So I think we've been, one, fortunate to have good policies which are coming into to kind of first identify this sector as an important sector.
Right.
Second is the ecosystems bodies such as Data Security Council of India, the number of other great ecosystem players who are helping nurture, including the the VC fraternity, the investment fraternity, investor fraternity, and then of course the great cybersecurity startups, and I think people who have worked and who've got sufficient amount of experience and now wanting to something, to build cybersecurity products and solutions. I think that's where I think it's all coming together. And of course, the geopolitical angle that is also playing out, which is favoring India. So I think this is our time and we should really ride on it.
Absolutely. And I'm so glad that you mentioned the geopolitical term, because that kind of, you know, brings me to my important and favorite topic, is geopolitics does have a bearing on cyber, whether it is you talking about the preparedness of any particular organization. Now, geopolitical considerations are indeed becoming very, very important. So how do you think this geopolitical landscape is going to pan out, given all the uncertainties that we are living in? And I'm talking about from a cyber standpoint. We all know that there are, you know, cyber spillovers, so to speak, of the conflicts that might be going on. So what do you have to say on that also?
So two things, right? So one is from a global context. From a global context, one of the key things that I believe that countries obviously would have certain requirements of data security, slightly associated with data sovereignty, and expect data to be, you know, one trend that we are definitely seeing is data should be within particular boundaries of that particular country, right? So I think that's one trend that is there, and I don't think that's going to go away. Realization that data is important for their respective, strategic reasons. That is number one. The second thing is, I think from an India standpoint, the second construct, I think because of the way the Indian ecosystem and the political regime, which is where we are now being able to, kind of have our good diplomacy with a lot of you know, emerging and developed countries. I think that's also helping us to play a larger role, not just in India, but on a global scale. So I think that is working in our favor as a country. And I think we can also contribute, not just for the business benefit, but also contribute for the cybersecurity ecosystem of not just India, but of the globe.
Absolutely.
And play a larger role of protecting the ecosystem, just like how we have done for IT.
Definitely, because, you know, so many other countries looking up to India as well,
right,
when it comes to beefing up their posture.
Right. And we, and to your point, we have done that in the digital payment space, right? As an organization, we've been, we've in the last 18 years, played a very critical role in the digital payment industry. And I think that, and digital payment industry as a country is all, you know, India has leapfrogged.
Right.
And I think that's, and now we are actually going ahead and seeing how other countries can adopt technologies like UPI, India Stack, and so on and so forth. So I think, and many of these are, you know, on goodwill gesture, right? And trying with the good interest of upbringing those economies and those societies. And I think that's how cybersecurity should be also going ahead and seeing how we can, you know, I was the other day, I was with the Cambodian delegation in Cambodia, right, with their senior leadership. And one of the key things that they were saying is, can we do something similar to what India did in the digital payment industry there in Cambodia so that it can help their society and their economies? So I think you're right. I think it's time for us to not just contribute to the country's cybersecurity posture, but on a global, what can we do in each of these economies and play a larger role?
Now, I certainly circle back to this point, but let me just, you know, shift gears to the technology piece. Because if you look at, you know, the way cybersecurity has been evolving technologically, really like your comments on that piece, that, you know, the underlying technological shift that you have been experiencing, right, as a security leader, also been running that organization. But from an overall technological standpoint, what do you think are those key drivers that are kind of, you know, affecting the overall cybersecurity, how cybersecurity is being done, how cybersecurity is being thought of, or how it is being conducted technologically? So what are the changes that you have witnessed in the past few years?
See, once again, two dimensions, right? One is on the global cybersecurity space and the Indian ecosystem that is there. So globally, from a cybersecurity standpoint, I think, you know, generally what I have observed over the last two decades is security usually is one which follows the technology trends, right? So for example, if you look at AI or you look at quantum, so first of course is AI emerges and then you look at AI security.
Yeah.
You look at quantum and then you look at quantum, you know, how quantum can impact cryptography, right? So on and so forth. So I think one on a global basis, there is definitely emergence of, because of the technology evolution. And I think one of the key things that is also the convergence of these technologies. The last event at the SCI, is, AISS, I had presented something called The Future is Faster Than You Think, which is based on this book, Faster Than You Think, right?
Yeah.
And one of the key things that we speak about there and I presented was that the convergence of technologies that is going to happen, right, or is happening at this point in time, which includes, say, for example, 3D printing, to lightweight materials coming into picture, to lithium batteries, to AI.
Yeah.
And this is actually, you know, giving rise to something called, something like the electrical vertical landing and takeoff, right, which is flying cars, which is now becoming possible because of all these convergence of technologies that are coming into picture. So I think in a broader sense, technology is leapfrogging in not just one area, it's in multiple areas. And then what is so exciting about that is because they're all converging. And because they're converging, it just gives quantum jump to the way we are all going to live our future, right? In the next decade or so, to your first point. And then consequently, security is going to you know, get more and more, because when there's quantum jump in technology, security also has to catch up. When I say security, privacy, the entire construct of protection. Now, from an Indian context, right, and I think India is obviously the highlight for the world in terms of the growth story, and, you know, for whatever it's happened, and it's predicted to be the the most, I mean, reach about, you know, arguably between $26 trillion to $55 trillion, wherever you put the number. But no one disputes the fact that we are going to be a leading, a developed economy in 2047, right? And at least we are working towards it.
Right.
That being said, I think India has a larger, you know, play, and that's how it's playing out here in India, with AI, with India being the host for GPI, and AI being so much of a government priority at this point in time, and also the ecosystem coming together, technology also playing in with AI talent, a lot of push on AI talent being created. I was given to understand that some of the quotes that was there is that the maximum number of AI certifications and engineering people, you know, number of hours professions are taking on AI is the highest in the world. Of course, we obviously have more engineers,
right.
But even then, I think, so there's a lot of good talent that is getting developed in India right. on AI. So I think you will see a lot of these technologies being used both for cybersecurity standpoint so that at the end of the day, organizations can really benefit.
Right.
So I think from a technology standpoint, one of the key things that's going to, what's exciting is no longer India will be a consumption of technology, which we used to do earlier, right? So where we used to buy cybersecurity products.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that will continue. We'll still buy products from the outside, but we'll also develop great products. And that's what we tell our customers, right? So at the end of the day, when they buy products and solutions from us, we tell them, yes, we are an Indian company, but we are better than some of the products and solutions that exist there, or we compete with some of the best in the world. So I think we're getting there.
No, I really like the way you have baked in the emerging technology concept, because to my mind, emerging technology, as you mentioned, has two facets. One is emerging technology being leveraged to beef up the cybersecurity part, and one is securing that emerging tech. Right, because emerging tech in itself needs that security architecture built on top of it in order to make sure that there are no negative ramifications, or if there are, they're taken care of. Right, no, I believe, I'm pretty much in agreement with what you said. You know, you mentioned DPI, you mentioned, let me take a step back and talk about digital finance, because I think that is one area, as you mentioned, where we have taken an authentic lead. Right. And given the way, our DPI is being taken to different geographies and different geographies actively exploring that particular concept. So I think that overall financial transaction processing, we have been able to successfully unbundle with so many players coming into digital finance space and so many possibilities being enabled. Right. Whether it's the fintechs or the overall ecosystem. But has security been able to catch up? With the digital finance booming so much in the country, has security been, able to reach that level? Or if not, where are the gaps that you primarily see?
Firstly, what I feel is that, it wouldn't have leapfrogged if security was not intact. All right. So if security was not that good, then technology, because typically if in anything in finance or payments or digital payments, so to speak, in our industry, if you run any survey and amongst the consumer, if security is not there, no one would adopt it.
Right.
Right. So that option, that's the first priority. If you and I were to transact
yes.
with our own money, if it's not secure, we don't want to transact.
Yes.
So security is been there. Right. And that's one of the reasons why technology has leapfrogged, and today you can make a payment. I mean, a decade ago, no one would dream that you can actually go down Bangalore roads and drink a tender coconut and pay a UPI transaction,
yeah.
right? So someone would brush it off as a joke.
Right.
But today it's possible because common man has been able to really benefit from this technology, right? And that's because of the security that has been thought through. As you know, I've been a volunteer for UPI from the cybersecurity specs, and everything we have kind of kept in mind while we designed the cybersecurity specifications for some of these technologies that are there. But can we done more? Absolutely yes, right? We have just scratched the surface and we have a lot of catching up to do. The way I look at it is that as a consumer, I should be least bothered about security. I should use the technology without worrying about security.
Yeah.
And that is the responsibility of professionals like you and me in the space, so that the common man doesn't need to worry about whether his money is going to be safe in his bank account.
Right.
Because he has people like you and me to take care
yeah.
to make sure that nothing untoward happens. But to that journey, it's a continuous improvement, right? And I don't think at any point in time we can say that it's there. But and more so, I think we have a lot more responsibility now because of the extent amount of transactions that are happening and the kind of the release that RBI just did yesterday, like the ULI, Unified Lending Interface,
yeah.
which is a new thought-breaking approach.
Yeah.
Now all these things if we have to kind of really make sure that the common man really gets benefited,
yeah.
as security professionals, you and I need to make sure that all those things are taken care of.
Absolutely, rightly said. So Darshan, you talked about, you know, our overall prowess in the digital financial space, but then again, my problem is that from standpoint of frauds and cybercrimes, the, you know, we have been facing quite a bit of challenge. So what are those interventions, in your opinion, that should be taken? Or I know that we as DSA are also involved in, you know, a lot of initiatives where we are working with different agencies and ecosystem players, you know, to effectively counter this. But somehow, you know, we haven't been really able to kind of, you know, get to the bottom or strike the root of the problem. So what should be done in your opinion? For
Brilliant question. And I've been thinking about this, Aditya, actually. And one of the, my personal thought is that it has to be driven from the top. And one of the key things is from the board, right, in organizations. Because I was given to understand, I read this data, not really accurate in terms of the number, but it's a single digit percentage of people who are cybersecurity specialists on the boards today.
Yeah.
If my memory serves me right, around 6%, which is fairly low for a company or for a country which has to climb up from, you know, as per MIT study, yeah, we are 17th in the world out of 20th. In cyber resilience as a country, right, as per MIT's review. In terms of cyber resilience, that means that if you want to actually become a developed country, we need to climb up that numbers, not by one or two, but by dramatically, right? And for that to happen, one is awareness, right? And we all know that. But how do you do the awareness? It has to start from the top. So one of the key things that I would, from the ecosystem, is to see somehow if we can, A, one is through education, and second is through mandate, have at the board levels, strong cybersecurity professionals either being on the boards of companies or they being cybersecurity experienced or experts sitting at the board levels.
Right.
That will drive the entire ecosystem. The right questions being asked at that level will make sure that the rest of the organization falls in line. You know, that's something that I think can really, really make a big difference. Because today, you know, it's a no-brainer, right? And because once you look at it, the ransomware breach, or an average ransomware breach, costs about $5.5 million, right? That's the statistics that is out there in the market.
Right, right.
But if you look at it, organizations will, you know, kind of haggle for even spending, say, $550,000 to protect their environment when they know in an average of 3 years, they are going to be breached, right? In typically,
it's a big irony.
Big irony is that when you know, even mathematically, right, if you were to take it, so even if I say $1.5 million spent against $5.5 million, I'm not even taking reputation damage. I'm not at all taking. So financial numbers does not add up there.
Right.
So why are they making such decisions? Why are organizations making the decisions? Because at the end of the day, the current decision makers in the cybersecurity are not able to prioritize where they need to spend, and they have been asked the wrong questions, or, you know, maybe not been asked all the right questions, right?
Yeah.
So if at the board level, you are able to get that kind of leadership,
right,
I think will dramatically change the structural, you know, construct of how organizations will make decisions. That is one.
Right.
Second is, I think, which is already happening, which is on the regulatory framework, which is more, lot more accountability.
Yeah.
But that accountability should also be driven to the boards, not just to the executive leadership level, at the CEO's level and all that, right? Because I'm sure CEOs have to be accountable, and so is the case with chief information security officers. But one level higher is what I think the entire accountability should start.
Right.
So I believe these are the two things that I could think of. And of course, I'm also not a very big fan of both structural and smaller reforms, which are tactical reforms, which has to be done.
Yeah.
So structurally, these are one thing is at the board level, if you're able to bring in that leadership, that is one great structural reform that we can do, which will give compounding effect to the to making the right decisions for organizations to leapfrog in terms of their cyber resilience. Second is in terms of, you know, tactical things which we can all do, for example, cyber skill, you know, awareness, education, so on and so forth.
Right. See, because if, even if you look at the recently unveiled resiliency framework of SEBI, or if you look at go to the IRDAI, or for that matter RBI, because RBI has been one of the most active regulators, so now they are increasingly holding the boards accountable, right? They are actually delineating specific responsibilities that the board should have. You know, from a cyber expertise standpoint, boards should be able to comprehend the kind of risks that they are sitting on. So I think these are all positive steps which are happening, and the regulators are kind of nudging the organizations in that direction, and all the sectors are kind of gradually catching up. And I think they would be positively reinforced to make those changes that you were saying. No, I think fair enough. Again, shifting gears yet again, from a CISA standpoint, right? Because a lot of young entrepreneurs would also be listening into this conversation. So they would also want to understand, because, the transition that you have done from being a services company to now being a product. So because fundamentally the character of a service company and a product company are very different, right? So how was this transition for you? What were the challenges? And for anyone who might be maybe planning to follow in your footsteps or whatever. So what would be the core considerations, so to speak?
Yeah, so one, of course, just because, one A organization did that, it may not be the right thing, because obviously circumstances,
right,
timing, there are lots of things which would, when we started off,
yeah,
way back, then, we started off as a services organization,
yeah. Yeah.
Right? And that's the only way you can bootstrap an organization to success. I mean, because products obviously have a lot of investments, mm-hmm, that is required. You need investments, and obviously the ecosystem was not really there.
Right.
And second, of course, we always believed that, like Vinod Khosla says, right, at the end of the day, we, 70% of the VCs don't help, and 90% of the VCs actually do more harm than good. So to some extent, I mean, not 100% saying that that's true across, but that's the number that it's always there in our back of our mind, that when we get people on board, they need to understand and they need to get the priority. So that's been our, so that we essentially can do what is right for the company as well as what is right for our customers, being a very customer focused organization, right? So that's how we drew our journey. But it's not necessary that everyone, because the ecosystem is different.
Right.
So I would just say that everyone has to do what they feel is right, mm-hmm, and based on their strengths,
yeah,
and their what is the current market conditions. Because now I think there is definitely capital available. Investors are keen to invest.
Yeah.
So that's definitely, but that was not the case 15 years back. And plus, of course, there is still, even in the Indian ecosystem, I still feel one of the key things that I will tell all entrepreneurs to watch out is still the Indian investor community, yeah, is not wise enough to advise you on cybersecurity decisions.
Mm.
So one of the key things that I'm very wary of is the, what Elon Musk also calls the MBAization, where you have younger, street smart, no offense to them, but they come at the board level and tell you what you need to do in order to build your company, which is completely useless in terms of getting that advice, right? So when you get this money, be very careful about who's going to sit on your board, whether they understand cybersecurity, they can advise you.
Yeah.
And most importantly, one of the key things is to make sure that you don't get advised wrongly, right? So when you're raising money, that's the only thing that I would say that people have to be watchful, especially entrepreneurs, because for an investor, he's running multiple companies, but for an entrepreneur, that's your only company. You put your head and heart and soul into that particular organization, so that's all that you've got. So it's a different pedigree, whereas an investor wants to make a quick exit in 5 years. For our philosophy, we've been long-term players. We've always wanted to play for longer run, put India on the global map. We're very passionate about doing that. And for us to dictate our own, or determine our own future, we want to control as much as we can what we can control. No offense to the investors community, but it's the brutal reality that Indian investor ecosystem needs a few more years before they, have their own learning curve, where they make some good and bad investments,
yeah,
and they realize where they are and then do that, compared to a Silicon Valley investor who would have done all those learnings and then can give you those things today.
I hope the investors are listening to you. Okay, so you talked about putting India on the global map, right? So I think that branding India on the key platforms and global arena is extremely crucial. Right. So what do you think, because you've also, you interact with various different markets, and you also are a strong believer that India can contribute significantly to especially the developing countries and their posture. So from promoting brand India on global platforms, what more do you think needs to be done? And what best practices, if you will, we could perhaps emulate from what other countries have been doing when it comes to promoting their own brand in international markets?
So first of all, I mean, a big thing to Data Security Council of India, like what you did, the drive in US, in multiple other countries, I think we are on the right path there, because what NASSCOM did to IT is perhaps what DSCI can do to cybersecurity. And that's what I feel. There's a lot of opportunity to take, and it has to be driven by the industry. There's only so much that government can do. Of course, I'm not saying the government cannot do, which government can frame policies. And the best thing, like Mr. Narayan Murthy says, right? So government should get out of the way and make it easy for any entrepreneur, including cybersecurity entrepreneurs, to flourish. I think my personal opinion, the best thing any government can do is cut loose, and make entrepreneurs or any businesses, avoid red tapism, avoid. And let entrepreneurs do, because that's what they will do, and because of the necessity of success, and they're going to flourish rather. So just to answer your question, I think it's about, one is that bodies like DSCI, other influencers in the marketplace who can take this India brand globally, and also encourage the ecosystem. And from a government standpoint, is just favorable, if not favorable, at least no negative policies, and which includes both central and state. I'm not just isolating any one particular things here, but at every level, making sure that entrepreneurs really don't have a problem, getting licenses, for example, getting these permits. It's today the fact remains that entrepreneurs still struggle with all the benefits that we are giving. Definitely it is improved, but we have still a long way to go. We had the Singapore body, investment forum coming here, ready to cut us a big check if we were to just move to Singapore. We are looking at that kind of things here, because cybersecurity companies are hot. Right. And if India wants to attract and build the next, the best cybersecurity products, which we should do, and solutions, they need to encourage entrepreneurs to stay in India, not move their head offices to Singapore or the US, but come back, build from India and for the world.
Right. So speaking of problems, yet another problem is, first is spotting the talent, finding it, attracting it, retaining it, and of course, nurturing it along the way. So that is like a big pain point for a lot of organizations. I'm pretty sure that, in your journey of so many years where you have built the organization from the scratch and now, a successful company. So that talent problem still persists in the market and big time, although, different players in the ecosystem are trying to come up with solutions. And government is also doing quite a lot of bit when it comes to creating that talent pipeline. But somehow we are falling short. So if we are falling short, what are the primary reasons for that?
So very good question. And one of the key things I feel, and this was there even earlier, is that one of the key thought processes that I have is we are creating talent for button pushers. What I mean by button pushers is, that's how the talent pool was created in India, right? In cybersecurity standpoint, because I remember interviewing a lot of people for our, we are in our security operations center here in Bangalore, right? And one of the key things that when we interviewed people, they were always trained on, say, an SIM product, and all that they knew is to push a button and then it does something, right? So that's the training and that's the skill that we are building. Right. But that's no skill if you want to really be a leader in cybersecurity. Right, so you need to be able to do advanced skills in cybersecurity. Now, first and foremost is curriculum and the construct of what we are going to teach our younger generation on cybersecurity. Right, we need to teach them cutting edge cybersecurity technologies. Like, for example, how do you do a reverse engineering of a malware? Right, I don't know how many of them, how many courses are running, how many institutes are even equipped to teach about this. Or, for example, how do you do hardware security constructs, right, which DSCI and CISA is working for a lot of initiatives. So what we need to do is the curriculum and the education pieces should be driven for building world-class cybersecurity talent, not just for button pushers. right? While it will be good, it will get you a placement in some MNC or a GCC job. But if you really want to put India on the global map for cybersecurity, you need to create that wow talent. Now, as far as companies like us, what can we do? Because we can't keep complaining, right? And as entrepreneurs, one thing that we all need to learn is not to complain, because we can't complain, right? So is to innovate. And that's where we need to, what we have done is we have partnered with universities. We are helping them. And there are fascinating things that are happening in, and one of the key things in India, I believe India has one of the best talents in the world. I've seen some of those young kids, and their determination to do a lot in cybersecurity is phenomenal. All that we need to do is give them a good opportunity. And our, from CISA standpoint, is to make sure that we give those opportunities. So we are working with Dayanand Sagar. We had a strategic MOU with Dayanand Sagar University, where we are helping them reframe some of those constructs where they are able to make sure. We are doing 1 year internship. We are opening up an incubation center in Dayanand Sagar. And so on and so forth. So there are universities which are coming up. Recently, I was at IISc Bangalore. We are trying to do some initiatives with IISc. So there is open-minded thought process in universities and colleges, which we need to ride on, and we need more of it. We need, the only thing that I would say, that the education system should not be looking out for how can the placement, but how can we create wow? I mean, I'm not saying placement is bad, but I'm just saying that it is not just about getting 50 placements on some old SIM tool or a product, or a IAM solution, which you just need to do and get a job, a low value job. We need to be able to create cutting edge cybersecurity talent, which will build, like, which we can hire for R&D, which we can build, which can hire for cutting edge security technologies, so that more work comes to India for cybersecurity and securing the world, which we started off.
No, absolutely. Because one is that we are servicing clients across, and India is being indeed looked upon as a talent pipeline, right? Especially from a cyber standpoint. So what you talked about, building those foundational skills, and not just vanilla skills, but advanced skills, right? Because even if you look at the ways, security has shifted. Earlier, it was more like, very focused on assessments, very focused on audits. But now it's more about response and being resilient, as you mentioned. And more importantly, real-time management of problems. That can't happen if we have just vanilla skills. And that too, being focused on, let's say, A solution or B solution, but having clarity about the underlying architecture and engineering concepts. I think that's very, very important. No, thank you so much for, shedding light on this piece as well. One last piece which I would like to talk to you and, gain your perspective is around compliance. Because the way, and this, again, since we are talking a bit heavily on the financial sector, although this is applicable across, that multiple regulations are there and multiple reporting agencies are there. That's a fact of the life. But how can organizations go about, the regulatory compliance burden, so to speak? How can they navigate this or browse this complex landscape of, compliances and regulations which are coming in, and a bouquet of legislations which are kind of, next in line, and so on and so forth? I know they have a very, very positive impact on the overall growth story as they nudge you towards making your defenses strong. But at the same time, it does take a toll on you, and you have to, respond to that challenge. So how does an organization, especially from a medium sector, not having those fancy resources at their disposal, how can they respond to this regulatory challenge?
Yeah, so first is, it's a very, very apt question, especially from a digital payment industry, and which is highly regulated. And regulated for the right reasons, because it deals with the common man's money.
Right.
Right. So obviously it has to be regulated, because it impacts you and me on our day-to-day lives. Because when I'm holding data as an organization in the digital payment industry, it is not my data. It is the data of the community, of the society, and hence I am, responsible, and as a fiduciary responsibility, to make sure that data is protected. So hence regulators are asking me, as an organization in the ecosystem, to make sure that the data, when it's in my position, it is maintaining certain requirements. So the first and foremost is to understand, and all organizations have to realize that compliance is a path towards security. And one of the key things that we at CISA have always advocated right from the day one is not to follow the check the box approach. Because, what do I mean by the check the box, right? So it's just about just doing it for this particular sake and then you know, and just going on with your business. There is a smart way to do that. And I know business compulsion. And I'm no way saying that you don't have to have a GTM. You can wait for your N number of months or quarters to kind of go through your GTM. You have a go-to-market. You have a run rate where you need to meet your investors' commitments and so on and so forth. So right, for right reasons, you need to do that. But having said that, there is an opportunity for all organizations to do compliances in the right way, keeping through security in mindset, right? So at the end of the day, these compliances are not asking you to do something way different from what is the right thing to do. They are actually saying, because they're all driving it through what is good cybersecurity hygiene. And there is no compliance standard which says that do something which is for the heck of doing it, right? So first of all, understanding that these compliances are good for the organization is something that you need to realize. Second is over compliances, which is some of these things are done for, like, for example, I'm a customer and you are my provider, and there are multiple customers for you. Everyone is asking you for the same compliance mandate. You have done this, you have done that, five things. So there is a smart way to address these issues, which I think as a community we need to realize that don't ask for these kinds of compliances and just do the check the box approach. Right. So for example, if I just want to meet my, because tomorrow if something goes wrong in my environment because of you, I'll hold your neck.
Yeah.
Which is what you should do it in the cover. But if I send you a 100-page questionnaire and then make sure that you pulled in something which I don't even today, I can tell you a fact that many people are asking many organizations questionnaires. But these questionnaires after being filled is not reviewed by anyone. Mm. It is just being filed and archived and no one is even looking into it. Yeah. That is what I call check the box approach. Mm. But if you really look at it and truly do it, so if the intent is right, I'm sure it will all be in the benefit of the ecosystem. So each organization should look at these compliance standards in the right way, in an organization that I can truly do it. Is it good for my organization? And do it in the right spirit. Because there are two approaches. One is the easy approach, just check the box approach, or do it with the true spirit of that particular requirement or control which is there. For example, I have, say, a multi-factor authentication. Now, if I want to do it rightly, I will do multi-factor authentication for all critical applications and all applications that are in my environment. Or I can do it only for two. Or I do it in a way that is insecure and then check the box and still meet the requirement. Now, which way do I need to do it, right? And why is the multi-factor authentication required? Because there is obviously, various spear phishing attacks, phishing attacks. So if you understand the intent of that particular thing, and then you start addressing those things, it is always for the benefit of the ecosystem. Yeah. So, but then problem is, once again, comes back to the earlier question, right? So people, education, the reason why it's required to be done, and also the discipline of getting things done, right? Because every compliance, everyone wakes up in the last minute. And in India, that's how we work with 6 or 10 top digital payment companies in the country. And we work with Hool. So one of the key constraints that everyone has is, whether we can take a compliance mandates a month in advance or 2 months in advance. It will be a lot more easier for organizations to plan for it, but it should not be in the last minute. It doesn't help them. It doesn't help the ecosystem. It doesn't help the security posture of the organization.
Yeah, right. No, I think during the course of our conversation, you've brought in multiple such points. So before I let you go, my parting query to you, more like, advice, so to speak, for all those young entrepreneurs who are yet to, kickstart their venture, but they're seriously considering cyber, right? And they might be having that bent of mind and acumen and the technical know-how, but may not know which path to follow. I know it's going to be a different journey for everyone. It cannot be the same. You can't apple to oranges. But what are your 3 or 4 recommendations which you think might work for most of them?
Yeah, so first of all, it's hard, but then let me make an attempt and hopefully be useful for people who are listening in. Right. So first is, I think you need to choose a problem which is something that you are passionate about. Right, in cybersecurity, whichever problem that you have, right, which you are very passionate about. I've seen people just going ahead and choosing a problem and for just because someone said that there is some other company or the 5 companies investing so much money into it, and hence I will go and chase that problem. It doesn't make sense, right? So you need to be passionate about a problem, right? A problem that you really, really are closely attached. You've seen that as a cybersecurity manager, cybersecurity officer, or for that matter, you're right out of a college. You've been working on that particular project for some time, and you feel that there's a genuine problem in that industry. Right. I think first is, you know, being passionate about identifying the right problem and being passionate about it. Right. Second is the product market fit. Right. Because most times what problem that we think is the real problem is not really the problem which the customers think it is. Right. So or the target customer audience thinks. So in CISA, we are proud of many failures as much as we are proud of many successes. Right. So we had many successes, but many people don't talk about the number of failures that we have had. For example, one of the key things that I can talk about the failures that we had is, we had during the COVID time, we launched a product called CISA Empower, which no one talks about it today. But that was a tool which was for monitoring work from home assets. But then for privacy reasons, it didn't succeed. We thought it was a brilliant product. We went to the customers. They said it's a brilliant product. And then when we started selling, no one was ready to pay. Right? So product market fit is despite we thinking it is the best product or best solution in the world, when you reach out to the customers, there'll be hundreds of other reasons which you may not have anticipated. In fact, in this case, we had a product market fit. We had customer calls because of our existing customer profile. We had everyone said it was a phenomenal product. When you launch, we'll buy. But when we went there and we started selling it, people said, hey, this is a product which our privacy, our DPO didn't agree. Yeah. Our data protection officer didn't agree because you're going to do employee monitoring, which violates privacy requirements. Little did we know. So the second construct is product market fit. And third is, of course, being persistent with the problem and the solution. So many people give up. Right. For all reasons, we talk about success. But we don't talk enough about our failures, right? So one of the key things is for every success, there are people who have failed. And even in those successes, people who have failed as well. So being persistent enough, because at the end of the day, you need to hold on for long. It's not going to... Entrepreneurship looks more like a 100-meter race, but it's not. It's more of a marathon. You need to be able to stick on, put your neck out, sustain. It's a lot of sacrifice. And both on a professional and the personal front, right? And like what Mr. Murthy says, I keep quoting him because he inaugurated our campus and he was long-term gratification, right? So you should be in for a long-term gratification. It is not going to come in 2 years, 3 years. And if you're thinking about that, hey, you'll have a $100 million exit in the next 5 years, that's not the right approach. Maybe you will have one. I'm no way discounting it, and people have had it. But if that should not be a basis for setting up the company, I'm sure people who have exited have never thought of it at that point in time, to immediately exit. Yeah. So those are my three basic whatever 2 cents that I had to share, if it's of any use.
I think this would resonate with a lot of them because they may not have that thought with respect to respecting the failures. But Darshan, thank you so much. It's been phenomenal having you, and you covering a host of issues for us. Thank you once again for joining us today.
Thank you, Aditya, for having me. It's always a pleasure. And thank you for those brilliant questions as well. Thank you. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.